Chapter 4, Creating the Pain Treatment Plan, has a lot of really robust learning assessment objectives. We want to be able to use all of the assessment tools that we've learned to begin to create an individualized treatment plan. We will recognize evidence-based non-pharmacologic options as well as non-opioid approaches and try to help to begin to align treatment approaches to specific types of pain. Also, we'll talk a little bit about precautions and considerations and identify adverse events and drug interactions that can occur with opioid use. Identify characteristics that will influence why we would use a certain opioid, and then begin to talk about documentation using informed consent and a patient-prescriber agreement, which should be used for all pain patients. We're talking about multimodal treatment plan for pain. On slide 34, we see a number of individuals who are working together as a team, and the patient is really at the center of this team. The patient needs to be engaged with probably more than one provider, and it's important that the goals of treatment should be based on what the expected outcomes of pain reduction are. And again, we've moved away from looking at the 11-point Likert scale that says that my pain is 9 out of 10 and we're going to try to get it to a 4 or a 3, and moved instead toward the paradigm shift of looking at functional outcomes and functional, realistic functional goals. So that is what we're going to be talking about. And we do have a number of options available. They're listed here: PTOT, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, pharmacotherapy, et cetera, with everyone working together as a team. The goal being to reduce pain, restore function, improve quality of life, and cultivate well-being. Slide 35 breaks it down in terms of the different types of treatments that may be applied in a multimodal fashion. Cognitive behavioral therapy has very good medical evidence for its effectiveness. It includes behavioral modification, cognitive restructuring, and meditation. Physical treatments we've mentioned already: exercise, acupuncture, movement, manual treatments, and so forth. Yoga, Tai Chi. I'm a big fan of aqua therapy. I believe that motion is lotion. If someone can move and remain mobile, they are going to experience not only improved quality of life, but in general, they will experience a reduction in their pain. Interventional treatments, of course, are available, including nerve blocks, injections, stimulators, or trigger point injections. And finally, we would consider pharmacotherapy as an option. And here's a list of most of the ones that we have available: nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, antidepressants, opioids, cannabinoids, anticonvulsants, and finally some topicals. The goal here, of course, being to enter into a therapeutic relationship with your patient in which the goal is to reduce pain and improve their quality of life by setting reasonable, achievable, functional goals for the patient. Here are some of the non-pharmacologic treatments that are available, and it's important for you to determine what's appropriate for your patient. They are all listed here, and I'm not going to read all of them, but there is a lot of good evidence to support all of them. If individuals are questioning whether these modalities are useful, we have in the tools repository, we have links to where you can find actual evidence of their use, which may be useful for some of your providers who are listening to this talk. We're going to skip the slides on cannabis and cannabinoids because that's really of not all states have medical marijuana available. But if we think now about pharmacologic treatments by type of pain, This is another animated slide, and it reflects what we saw in chapter one in terms of type of pain. And it breaks it out in terms of nociceptive, nociplastic, and neuropathic pain. Nociceptive pain will typically respond to antihistamines, immediate release opioids, nerve blocks, nonsteroidals, or topicals, while neuropathic pain may also respond to opioids, but we have more things in our armamentarium. Usually if someone has neuropathic pain, they may begin with immediate release opioid and may need to go on to long-acting opioids. But transdermals are also an option for patients with neuropathic pain. Anticonvulsants, nerve blocks, tricyclic antidepressants have been a mainstay for neuropathic pain ever since we were treating off-label. The treatment for trigeminal neuralgia for a long time was carbamazepine or Tegretol. So we do know that anticonvulsants have a lot of evidence for their use, and there are FDA-approved products for neuropathic pain. And then finally, we can consider nerve blocks. This new category of pain, nociplastic pain, responds to anticholinergics, to anticonvulsants, again to tricyclics and SNRIs, which are very, very helpful because they're much less sedating and don't have the problems of orthostatic hypotension that the tricyclics have. And then, of course, other serotonergic agents. The point on this slide is that while opioids may be effective in nociceptive and neuropathic pain, they are never effective in nociplastic pain. So identifying what type of pain your patient has is very important. And in the case of a patient with fibromyalgia or IBS or CRPS, opioids are off the table in terms of treatment. And then for all these different types of pain, clearly, we want to continue effective non-pharmacologic options at all times. The next slide complements the points that we made earlier about the nature of peripherally mediated slide, remembering that if the pain source is acute and it's peripherally mediated, it is being perpetuated by that neurotransmitter substrate or soup that includes things like bradykinin, histamine, et cetera. So it may make sense for this type of pain to use things that will work in the periphery, like anti-inflammatory substances, antihistamines, topical anesthetics, acetaminophen. Opioids can also be useful in this area, but they really don't do anything in terms of reducing the inflammatory substrate that we described earlier. This slide may look dichotomous, but it isn't. Recognizing that the brain is involved in all kinds of pain, whether it's peripherally mediated or centrally mediated pain, the brain is part of it. So it's conceivable that any of these substances could work for either type of pain. However, in centrally mediated pain, there are some types of medications that may be more effective and that would not necessarily work well for acute peripherally mediated pain. They are things like alpha-2 agonists, the anticonvulsants that we've already talked about, the gabapentinoids or the alpha-2 delta ligands that we know are very effective for neuropathic pain, calcium channel antagonists, NMDA receptor antagonists, certainly the tricyclics and the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors or the SNRIs, and then again, opioids. So opioids can be effective at any point along this chain of pain transmission, but there may be another option, and many of them are listed here. Before you prescribe, you have to consider a number of key characteristics. What's the route of administration? I'm a geriatrician, so some of my patients can't swallow. We may need to use topicals, or we may need to have liquid substances that can be either flushed down a tube, or in the case of a drug like morphine, Roxanol, which comes 20 milligrams per ml, can be given in a very tiny buccally administered dose and be able to mitigate pain. The formulation, therefore, is very important. Certainly the strength is important based on the patient's level of tolerance or naivete to the drug if we're using an opioid. The interval is important. Drug interactions, instructions, specific safety concerns. And then when we're talking about use in opioid tolerant patients versus people who are not able to or have not developed tolerance, for opioid tolerant patients, we need to consider the relative potency to morphine of any substance that we're going to rotate to and then use that in an equianalgesic dosing. Mechanism of action is listed here, MOA. How does the drug work? Where does the drug work? And these are all characteristics that we need to be aware of when we're trying to select the appropriate medication or maybe two or three medications that we're using to treat pain. When it comes to considering an opioid, this should only be on the table when the potential benefits are likely to outweigh the risks. And we know the risks of opioids are significant, including endocrinological changes like hypogonadism, including the development of hyperalgesia, including the development of tolerance and the fact that we know we're going to have to be up-titrating the dose. So long-term high-dose uses of opioids come with this list of problems, which is why we have to be upfront with our patients and consider the long-term risks against the short-term benefits. Also consider an opioid only when the patients fail to adequately respond to non-opioid and non-pharmacological interventions. If we've tried the CBT, assuming that we're able to get that for our patient, or we've had the patient in physical therapy and we've done whatever other types of interventions we think may be useful, and nothing is really cutting it and it's really impacting the patient's quality of life and their ability to function, good time to consider an opioid. Also consider an opioid when the patient has neuropathic or nociceptive pain that is moderate to severe. And in fact, if we're going to be using extended release long-acting opioids, as per the FDA REMS, we should be only using them for patients who have severe pain that's recalcitrant to other forms of treatment. Here's our opioid misuse risk assessment toolbox. And you can see there's a number of them. The opioid risk tool has a new iteration, which is the opioid use disorder. Martin Cheadle has adapted it, and we're going to look at that in depth in a moment. There's the SOAP-P, which is the screener and opioid assessment for patients with pain, and then the DIER. You use the one that in your clinical practice which best suits you and which may be available in your electronic records, but you do have the ability to download these and scan them into whatever records you have. For patients who have the disease of substance use disorder, there are a number of other different ones, and they're listed here. There's the CAGE-AID, the RAFT, the DAS, the CTQ, and the ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale. All of these can be useful when you're assessing whether a patient is appropriate for a trial of an opioid. But very importantly, this blue box says, get a baseline urine drug test. You don't want to be caught off guard. Before you start, find out what else the patient is using. Is the patient using benzodiazepines that you were not aware of because they were prescribed by their psychiatrist? This would be grounds for having a nice conversation with the patient, letting them know that it would probably not be safe to use those concomitant with an opioid. In fact, we know it's not safe. Also check the prescription drug monitoring program for your patient before you even begin using opioids. Here's a closer look at the ORT. Something that you can do is have the audience score themselves or score a friend. And it's a brief 9-question measure, so you can classify a patient as either low or high risk, and it's very simple scoring. If the score is below or equal to 2, they're considered to be at low risk, and if it's greater than or equal to 3, these are individuals who are high risk who may require additional monitoring and a consultation or referral if you're going to initiate opioid therapy for them. These are the list of the opioid side effects and adverse events. The big one being, of course, respiratory depression, and we know that that's because there are mu receptors in the respiratory centers of the brain. So this is clearly the most dangerous and, in fact, deadly side effect that can occur with opioids. But we can also have opioid-induced constipation or myoclonus. OIC, of course, requires that as soon as you prescribe an opioid, you remember the not so golden rule, which is that the hand that writes the prescription for the opioid should be the hand that writes the prescription for the laxative, or it will be the hand that may need to perform the manual disimpaction. So I always like to remind the audience of the not so golden rule. When you write an opioid prescription, you're writing another prescription for usually Senicide, something for laxation. Sedation, cognitive impairment, clearly have to warn patients about operating machinery, driving vehicles, etc., because this can happen. And even over time, even if the individual does develop some level of tolerance to it, it should always remain as a potential risk. There are occasional allergic reactions. We already mentioned hypogonadism, and certainly tolerance, physical dependence, hyperalgesia are the other major side effects that we know are always associated with the use of opioids. How are side effects different from adverse events? Well, the side effects are things that we almost anticipate and should be warning our patients about, and then actually maybe attempting to mitigate these side effects. Adverse events are reportable: falls, fractures, addiction, overdose, hospitalization, disability, permanent damage, and death are considered to be the major adverse events that are listed by the FDA, with respect to use of opioids. Remember that opioid-induced respiratory depression is more likely to occur in people who are predisposed to respiratory problems, people with asthma, with obstructive sleep apnea, people who are morbidly obese, and on the other hand, those are who are cachectic or very debilitated and elderly. Anytime an opioid is given concomitantly with other drugs that may depress respiration, in particular benzodiazepines or other forms of sedatives, muscle relaxants. Clearly, you are putting your patient at risk for opioid induced respiratory depression. How can we reduce it? Well, don't overestimate your dosing. Start low and titrate to the patient's pain level in a cautious way. If you over titrate, you up titrate too quickly, it can result in a fatal overdose with the first dose. Always instruct patients that they have to swallow the tablets whole and remind them that crushing, dissolving, chewing the medications is extremely dangerous and can be fatal. It's important to remember that transdermal and transmucosal dosage forms cannot be cut, damaged, chewed, or swallowed, that the skin should be prepared, but it should not be shaved, and that people who are using transdermal formulations should avoid getting in a hot tub, a hot shower, or using a heating pad over the area because it can result in capillary vasodilatation and dose dumping that can go into the systemic circulation and result in respiratory depression. metal and foil backings are not safe for use in the MRIs. People who have fevers or, again, are in a heated environment need to be treated much with a great deal of caution. So there's a number of important features to the use of transdermal and transmucosal medications that have to be presented to your audience. Remember that you really do need to know about drug interactions, pharmacokinetics, and dynamics. Remembering that central nervous system depressants can potentiate sedation and respiratory depression. MAO inhibitor use, although we don't use them very often, can cause serotonin syndrome, so we have to be aware of that. Remembering that many opioids can prolong the QTC interval and that methadone requires additional caution, especially when initiating it or doing an equianalgesic dosing change. Some erlaparotics can rapidly release the opioid when exposed to alcohol, just as I described earlier with transdermal products rapidly dumping into a dilated capillary bed. And that opioids can reduce the efficacy of diuretics, inducing the release of ADH. Remembering that drugs that inhibit or induce the cytochrome P system enzymes also can increase or lower some blood levels of opioids. So it's important to be aware of them. The rule of thumb that I use with respect to, and again, now we're on the next slide, opioids and cytochrome P450 system enzyme interactions. The rule of thumb that I use are the four that are least likely to induce the cytochrome P450 system enzymes or the CYP3A4 enzymes, and they are, I like to think of them in terms of the acronym MOTH: morphine, oxycodone, tapentadol, and hydrocodone. I'm sorry, hydromorphone. So MOTH again is morphine, oxycodone, tapentadol, and hydromorphone. These drugs are less likely to interact with the cytochrome P450 system. So it's important to be aware if you're using another one and the patient is taking an antifungal or other medications that impact the CP450 system, be aware that there you may have difficulty. We've covered the drug interactions that are important to most opioids, and I think they're listed here on slide 52. With CNS depressants, we've already talked about sedation that can lead to coma, skeletal muscle relaxants, same thing. Agonists, mixed agonists, be careful when you're using them with a full opioid agonist. And then anticholinergic medications can increase risk of urinary retention, and severe constipation can also lead to paralytic ileus when used concomitantly with opioids. So there are some special populations that we should consider. Slide 53, we have all the white umbrellas with one outlier, which is the yellow one. And on the next slide, older adults, remember, are always at risk for respiratory depression because of the changes in distribution, metabolism, and excretion that occur in older individuals. So again, start low, go slow, consider reducing the starting dose by a third to a half in non-opioid tolerant patients, and clearly monitor them for sedation and warn the family about the potential for respiratory depression. It's very easy to teach people how to count respirations. Most people know how to check their pulse, so also checking someone's respirations makes a lot of sense, especially if you're initiating or up titrating an opioid. If someone's usual respiratory rate is 12 and they're breathing at half that or less than half that, they may in fact be developing respiratory depression, and it's time to intervene very quickly. Women of childbearing potential, the most important take home from this slide is that you should know the childbearing status or intention of your patient. because neonatal abstinence syndrome is not just very hard on the baby and the providers. There are congenital defects that are associated with opioid use in pregnant women. For women who are requiring opioids on a daily basis, it's felt that methadone or buprenorphine may be safer. If you're a provider of a woman who is intending to become pregnant and she's on opioids and you can wean her from opioids, that would be the best option. And failing that, clearly you need to co-manage this patient with pain specialty as well as OBGYN. Children, adolescents, the problem is quite simple. We don't have the studies. Most of the studies that have been done with opioids in children have been done in hospitalized patients. So the safety and effectiveness is just simply not established. Transdermal fentanyl has been approved in children over 2, and there is oxycodone extended release dosing changes for people in over the age, for children over the age of 11. But really, in children, the use of extended release long acting opioids are really for life limiting conditions. And clearly, ideally, you should be in consult with a pediatric palliative care team or a pediatric pain specialist for safe use of these in this population of patients. Other populations include people with sleep disorders or sleep disordered apnea, dementia, obesity, renal impairment, psychiatric disorders, and patients at the end of life. Certainly patients with substance use disorder may in fact need pain management with strong medications like opioids, and the fact that they are at risk for OUD should not prevent them from getting analgesia, but rather should prompt the provider to seek expert consultation with pain specialty. When do you want to consider the case of a trial of an opioid? Again, we've already discussed that. Informed consent is important. And informed consent is really your way of assuring that the patient understands their expectations, the risks of the product, alternatives, and also determining what their decision is to whether they're going to use it. On slide 60, there's a patient-provider agreement, which can reinforce expectations for appropriate and safe opioid use with clarification of goals, etc. Pill counts and urine drug testing should be a routine part of the treatment of patients or the care of patients who are using opioids. And it's important not to single them out, but rather to have this be a policy and a procedure so that all patients in the practice who are using opioids are all submitted to the same assessment of urine drug testing and occasional pill counts. It's also important in a PPA to identify what your exit strategy is so that in the event that you are no longer going to continue to prescribe, we have an idea of what's going to happen next. Will that entail a referral or what? One pharmacy, one prescriber, etc. And the PDMP is really useful in that because that enables us to see where the patient is getting their medications. And many of the prescription drug monitoring programs are now talking to adjoining states so that you can see if the patient's getting the medications, not just in your state, but in bordering states. When it comes to non-adherence of a PPA, I think of a patient-prescriber agreement as a prenup. And non-adherence to the prenup could result in divorce or, you know, dismissing a patient from your practice and having the patient have to find, locate another provider. This slide lists a number of these behaviors. Some of them, I think, may result in meeting with the patient and having a discussion or a sit down. An example might be an unsanctioned dose escalation or other non-compliance. And you can have a discussion with the patient about, you know, whether that's appropriate or not. Why are they, if they're using a drug, it's not uncommon for patients to use opioids, for example, to help them sleep. They say, oh, I take an extra one at night to help me sleep. Well, it's been shown that opioids actually disrupt sleep architecture. So doing that is destructive to the patient's sleep pattern. This is an opportunity to educate the patient. But what about things like getting prescription drugs from non-medical sources or other medical sources despite having warned the patient, or finding that the patient is engaging in forgery of prescriptions? These would be, I think, grounds for divorce, and that would require investigation at a minimum, and possibly, what we said earlier, having to find another provider for the individual. That concludes our discussion of Chapter 4. It's a lot of content, and I hope that my discussion of some of these slides with you will help you going forward. Thank you for participating in our Core REMS program, and best of luck. Signing off.